Start to do my best show wave. It is not me he is watching, though, but Noah. For a second, I consider pointing him out to her, but I do not want to make her even more nervous. A second later, he's gone. The cobblestone street narrows so that the parade presses close to the onlookers. Hands shoot out, small children eager to touch us. The spectacle, in ways that simply would have been rude with anyone else. They cannot reach us, though, and for that I am grateful. The faces in the crowd are different this year, eyes weary from the war, skin drawn more tightly across the cheekbones. But we are changed, too. Closer, one might see the cracks, the animals a bit too skinny. Performers using a bit of extra rouge to cover fatigue. The spectators follow the parade down the winding lane toward the market square, then onto another road that leads out of town once more. Though the incline is gentler than it had been on our ascent, the road is bumpy and uneven, marred with ruts and potholes. I put a hand across Noah and Theo as we are jostled so they do not fall from the bench. I might have suggested that she leave Theo with Elsie or one of the other workers. A baby has no place in a parade. But I knew that Noah would be nervous and draw comfort from having him with her. I study the child. He does not seem scared by the noise and crowd. Instead, he leans comfortably against Noah with his head cocked, seeming entertained by the commotion. A few kilometers farther, the pavement gives way to dirt. Noah takes in the crowd that runs behind. "They're still following us," she says. "I thought they might have lost interest." "Never," I reply. The onlookers keep up tirelessly. Women jostle babies and children pedal alongside on their bikes, their Sunday suits turning brown with dirt kicked up from the road. Even barking dogs join the melee, becoming a part of the parade themselves. A few minutes later, the road ends at a wide, flat grass field, broken only by a cluster of trees at one end. The wagon halts with an unceremonious bump. I climb down first, then reach out to help Noah. But she looks past me, eyes wide. The raising of the big top is almost as much of an attraction as the circus show itself, and not only because it is free. An army of workers with tents and metal poles and rope have fanned out over the field. The circus needs more hands than we can possibly bring with us, which is good news for the local men who are looking for work. They stand, bare-armed and perspiring, at the periphery of the flattened tarp, which covers the entire field, tied to stakes that surround it. "I feel useless just standing here," Noah says after climbing down from the wagon. "Should we be helping or something?" I shake my head. "Let them do their job. We can no more help raise the tent than the workers can swing from the trapeze." All of the prep work is done, but the real show has been saved for the crowd. Elephants, which had not been part of the procession, but brought here directly by the train, are harnessed. On command, they start walking away from the center, heaving the Hauptmast to its full height. Then the horses are led outward, pulling the shorter poles into place, and the whole thing seems to rise like a phoenix from the ashes. A tent the size of the massive gymnasium at Darmstadt, where seconds ago there had been nothing. Though they have undoubtedly seen it year after year, the crowd lets out a stunned gasp and applauds heartily. Noah watches silently, awed by seeing the big top go up for the first time. Theo, who had been chewing on his fingers, squeals with approval. The crowd begins to dissipate as the workers move to secure the poles. "Come," I say, starting in the direction of the big top. We need to practice. Noah does not move, but looks hesitantly from me to the child and back again. We've been on the road for almost 2 days, she complains. I'm aware, I reply, growing impatient. But we only have a few hours before we get ready for the first show. You have to rehearse at least once in the big top before then. Theo needs to be fed, and I'm exhausted. Her voice rises to almost a whine, and I am reminded yet again of just how young she is. I remember just for a second what it was like to want to do something else, to look through the window of the practice hall and see girls skipping rope in the valley and wish that I could join them. All right, I relent. Take 15 minutes. Go get him settled with Elsie. I'll meet you in the big top. I expect her to protest again, but she does not. Her face breaks into a wide smile of gratitude, as though given a great gift. Thank you, she says, and as she carries Theo in the direction of the train, I look back over my shoulder toward the big top. Acquiescing was not entirely for Noah's benefit. The workers are still tightening the poles. The trapeze is not quite ready. And she will rehearse better if she can concentrate on flying instead of worrying about Theo. As Noah disappears into the train, my doubts rise anew. Since she first let go and flew last month, she has grown stronger in her training. But she is still so inexperienced. Will she hold up day after day in front of the lights and the scrutiny of the crowd? I walk into the big top, inhaling the moist earth and damp wood. This is one of my favorite moments each season, when everything at the circus is fresh and new. Other performers, jugglers, and a few contortionists have trickled in, working on their own acts. Peter is not here, and I wonder if he is rehearsing privately, out of view, so as not to be rebuked for the political act Herr Neuhoff forbade him from performing. Peter had mentioned it a few days earlier.
Herr Neuhoff is trying to persuade me to water down the act. Bury it.
I know, I replied. He spoke to me about it as well.
What do you think?
Peter was normally so self-assured, but his face was troubled, and I could see he really did not know what to do. It was only because of me that he was considering acquiescing at all.
Don't stop yourself on my account.
I did not want Peter to have to sacrifice his art for me and resent me after. Now the workers have just finished securing the trapeze. The foreman, Kurt, has them do this before the seats and other apparatuses, knowing that I will want to practice right away. I walk to where he is conferring with two laborers about the angle at which the benches are to be set.
Has the ground been leveled? I ask.
He nods. It matters a great deal for the trapeze. The slightest unevenness in the earth could affect the speed at which we fly and destroy the precision of our routine, causing me to miss catching Noah. I walk to one of the ladders and give it a firm tug to make sure it is secure. Then I climb up to the flyboard. From below comes the murmur of some of the dancers chatting as they stretch. I leap without hesitating. The air rushes beneath me and I stretch forth. As always in this moment, I feel 16 again, the sound of my family's laughter ringing in my ears as I fly. When I first came back to the circus, I wondered if the time away would have made me slower, if I could remember the moves. I was in my late 30s, perhaps too old for this. Others by now had retired to teaching or marriage or seedy cabarets in Dresden or Hamburg. But the air was all I had known. I was good at it still. Why shouldn't I keep going? In a few weeks, my body thinned, the richness of those long dinners in Berlin melting from my midsection. And I was as good as I had ever been. Better, even, Herr Neuhoff remarked once. I could not tell him that I flew higher and flipped harder to reach a place in the dark eaves of the big top where I could hear my brother's laughter and where Eric's rejection could no longer find me. As I swing back up to the board a few minutes later, the chatter of the performers below stops abruptly and the tent grows quiet. Noah stands at the entrance to the big top, looking young and scared. The other performers eye her warily. They have not been awful in the weeks since she joined us, but they've been distant, making clear that she does not belong. It is always hard for new performers at the circus. Indeed, they had hardly welcomed me with open arms when I returned. And it is even more difficult for someone like Noah, who is seen as not qualified, too inexperienced to succeed. But am I any better, I wonder? I, too, had treated Noah coldly in the beginning, wished that she would go. Though I have accepted her since the police came to Darmstadt, I have viewed her as a necessity, part of the act. I have not done anything to make her truly welcome. Suddenly guilty, I climb down the ladder to her. I ignore the others, willing her to do the same. Are you ready? Noah does not answer, but looks around the tent. To me, this is normal, almost all I have known. But I see it as she does now. The cavernous space. Rows of seats being assembled endlessly after one another. I take her hand and stare hard at the others until they look away. Come. The ladders are looser here than in the practice hall, and everything shakes a bit more. I keep talking as we climb, partly to ease her nerves, and partly because there are things, important things, she needs to know about the differences between Darmstadt and the Big Top. After a lifetime, I can perform anywhere. The scenery fades, and it is just me and the bar and the air. For Noah, though, every little detail could make a difference. Let's start with something simple, I say. But there is terror in her eyes as she gazes downward. She is going to fold. Pretend they aren't there. She takes the bar with shaking hands and jumps. At first, she is jerky, reminiscent of her first day on the trapeze. Feel for it, I urge, willing her to remember all I have taught her. As she falls into the familiar forward and back rhythm, her movements smooth. Good, I say, as she returns to the board. I have been sparing with my compliments, not wanting to make her complacent. But now I offer more than usual, hoping to bolster her confidence. She smiles, drinking in my praise like water. Now, let's practice your release. Noah looks as if she wants to protest. I have no confidence that she is ready to do it here, but we have no choice. I go to the other ladder and climb to the catch trap, nodding at Goethe, who has been loitering with a few of the acrobats. She starts up the ladder behind Noah with disinterest. I study Goethe warily. She is no more welcoming to Noah than the other performers, but practical enough to tolerate her, because we need her for the act. As Noah nears the top of the opposite ladder, her foot slips, and she nearly falls. Easy, I call from my board. Though I mean it as reassuring, it comes out sounding like a rebuke. From below come laughs from the other performers, as their suspicions about Noah's lack of skill have been confirmed. Even from a distance, I can see her eyes begin to water. Then her back stiffens, and she nods. Noah jumps with more force than I have seen from her. Hop! I call. She releases with surprising precision for her first time in the big top. Our hands lock. Once there would have been a coach on the ground to give the commands, and men to do the catching. But with so many gone to war, we have only ourselves now. My brother Jules had been my catcher. Until these past few weeks of training Noah, I had not fully appreciated his strength and skill. As we swing back, I release her in the direction of the bar, which Gerda has sent out. With every pass, Noah's movements become stronger. She is performing in spite of, no, because of, the skepticism of the other performers. Grudgingly, the expressions below turn to respect. My hope rises. Noah has earned their respect, and she will earn the audience's too.
Bravo! A voice calls out from below.
But the tone is mocking. Noah, who is on the return, nearly misses the far board. Gerda reaches out and grabs her before she falls. I look down. Emmett is holding a mop high in the air, mocking Noah. I climb down the ladder angrily.
You fool, I hiss.
She's not an aerialist,
Emmett replies with exaggerated patience, as though speaking to a small child.
She was a cleaner at the station in Bensheim. That's all she's qualified to do.
Emmett, I know now, has been stirring up ill will among the other performers, encouraging them not to accept Noah. He has always needed to pick on others to hide his own weakness. But how had he found out she worked at the station? Surely, he does not know the rest of Noah's past.
Fine now, I demand. The show is in an hour. We need her ready, and you are undermining her confidence.
Because I didn't actually think we would go through with this farce, he replies.
Or that she would be able to do it, I add silently. A part of him, I suspect, is jealous. Noah has been able to manage mightily with just weeks of practice, whereas he has been here a lifetime with no talent to show for it. But it seems unwise to point this out to him now.
This needs to work, Emmett, I say slowly. For your sake, he sneers. For all of our sakes, I correct.
Noah, who has come down the ladder, watches from a distance. She has heard enough, I know, to be uncomfortable. There is a flash in her eyes as she expects to be rejected yet again. How is it possible, after all that she has been through, that she can still let people hurt her? She stands on one side of me, the rest of the performers on the other. I am an island, caught in between. I take a step in her direction.
We need Noah,
I say firmly and loudly enough for the others to hear. It is a calculated risk. I need the good graces of the circus folk as much as she does, in order to maintain my identity and hide. No one responds. But I've gone too far to back down now.
In any case, I am with her, and anyone who isn't is against me.
Noah's face folds with disbelief, as if it is the first time that someone has stood up for her. The others scatter to rehearse.
Come, let's go get ready for the show,
I say, taking her hand and leading her from the big top.
You shouldn't have done that,
Noah says when we are outside. Though we are well out of earshot of the others, her voice is barely a whisper.
You have to think of your own safety.
Nonsense. I wave my hand dismissively, though in fact, she is right.
You must harden yourself to the impressions of others.
And what do you think?
Her voice is breathy. Despite what I have just told her, I can tell she cares about my opinion more than just about anything. Do you think I am ready?
I hesitate. I think she needs another year of training. I think that even then, she might not be able to do it, because the lights and 1,000 eyes upon you change everything. I think that we do not have a choice.
Yes, I lie, unable to look at the brightness of her smile. And together, we go prepare to perform.
Chapter 9. Noah. I follow Astrid away from the big top. Outside, spectators still mingle, buying tickets at a hastily erected kiosk and watching the workers put up the smaller tents. Crew bosses shout orders, their hoarse voices mixed with the clanging of hammers, driving metal spikes into hard earth. "Thank you," I say, referring once more to what had just happened with the other performers. Once I thought Astrid would never accept me, but she stuck up for me, and she thinks I can do this. She waves her hand dismissively. "We can't worry about any of that now. We must prepare for the show. It starts in an hour." "So soon?" I ask. "It's after 4. I had not realized it had gotten that late, or that the parade and tent raising had taken so long. "We begin at 6, earlier than we otherwise would have because of the curfew. We need to get ready." "I thought we already did." I look down at the dress she had loaned me an hour earlier on the train, so tight that my parents would have a fit if they saw me in it. Ignoring my last remark, Astrid leads me across the crowded field to where the train has come to a rest at the end of the tracks. "The fairgrounds were built close to the tracks so we can sleep in the railway cars," Astrid explains. She gestures in the opposite direction toward some trees. "There are a few cabins and tents we could use if it was warmer. This isn't a great village for us," she adds in a low voice. "The mayor has become very close to the Germans." "He's collaborating?" I ask. She nods. "Of course we didn't know that last year when we booked the dates. And canceling surely would have aroused too much suspicion. Because above all else right now, it is essential to maintain the pretense of normalcy. We'll stay in Tears for nearly 3 weeks, though, because it's centrally located, and people will come from all over Avonia for the show." At the train, Astrid steers me to a carriage where I have not been before. The rail car is warm and crowded with women changing into costumes and patting on heavy makeup. I pause to watch one of the acrobats paint her legs a darker shade of tan. "She does that because her tights are too ripped to repair," Astrid explains, noticing my curiosity. "There simply aren't more to be had. Come." She chooses a costume from the rack against the wall of the train car and holds it up against me. Then she hands it to one of the dressing girls and disappears. I am thrust from one set of arms to the next, like a bundle of laundry, embarrassed by my own stale smell from too many hours on the train without washing. Someone pulls the dress Astrid has chosen over my head. Another declares it too loose and begins to pin. Am I really to wear it? It is smaller even than a swimming costume, no more than a bra and a bottom. My stomach, tighter than when I came to Darmstadt from all of the training but still far from perfect, spills over the elastic top of the briefs. The costume is ornate scarlet silk with gold trim. It carries a faint odor of smoke and coffee that makes me wonder who had worn it previously. Astrid reappears, and I gasp. Her two-piece, scarcely a few handkerchiefs woven together, makes my costume look modest. But Astrid is born to wear it, Her body is chiseled from granite, like a nude goddess statue in a museum.
You want I should try to flip in a hoop skirt?
She asks, noticing my reaction. To her, the immodesty of the outfit doesn't matter. She does not wear it to entice, but to perform well. Estrid gestures for me to sit on an upturned crate. She takes rouge and dots my cheeks and slashes my mouth with cherry red like a clown. Other than the times I had stolen a bit of Mama's powder to look older for the German, it is the first time I have worn makeup. I stare at the stranger in the cracked mirror someone has placed on top of a steamer trunk. How have I come to be here? Estrid, seemingly satisfied, turns away and begins applying her own makeup, which, with her unblemished skin and long eyelashes, hardly seems necessary. Do I have a few minutes? I ask. I want to go check on Theo. Estrid nods.
Only just. Don't be gone too long.
I start down the narrow corridor in the direction of the sleeper car, hoping that the sight of me in strange makeup will not scare Theo. But as I begin to pass through the next carriage, I stop, hearing voices.
They want a show of our allegiance as part of the performance.
I crane my neck to hear better.
It is Herr Neuhoff, his voice low and terse. Perhaps a rendition of Maréchal Nous Voilà. Impossible!
Peter snarls at the mention of the Vichy anthem. I jump back so as not to be seen.
I've never been told what to perform by the government, even during the Great War. If I didn't kowtow to the Tsar, I'm sure as hell not going to do it now. It is more than just politics. This is about the integrity of the show. Things are different now, Herr Neuhoff presses. And a little indulgence might go a long way toward helping things.
There is no response, but the stomping of footsteps and a door slamming so hard the whole carriage shakes. A bell rings, which Estrid had told me earlier was to summon us to the backyard, the area behind the big top where we will assemble and get ready to perform. I look longingly down the corridor of the carriage. There is no time to see Theo. Outside, the once barren field around the big top has been transformed with a half dozen smaller tents that seem to have popped up like mushrooms. The midway is filled to capacity with men in straw hats, women and children in their Sunday best. At the entrance to the big top, a day bill had been posted, touting the acts that one would see inside. Smaller acts, the jugglers and sword swallowers, give impromptu performances to lure the crowds. A brass band plays lively tunes to the queue at the ticket window, easing their wait. The air is perfumed with the sweet thickness of candy floss and boiled peanuts. Such treats hardly seem possible with rationing and so many struggling just to eat. For a moment, I am giddy, a young girl once more. But the treats are here for those lucky few with the sou to spend. Certainly not for us. I skirt around the edge of the big top. A handful of young boys are lying flat on the ground, trying to peek beneath the tent. But one of the seasonal workers shoos them away. The periphery of the tent has been adorned with tall posters of the starring acts. Estrid, in her younger years, looms above me, suspended mid-air by satin ropes. I am transfixed by her image. She must have been about the same age I am now, and I am so curious to know her. I pass the beer hall they directed at the end of the midway, a bookend to the carousel opposite. Boisterous male laughter explodes from within. It is a delicate balance, Estrid had explained. We want to lubricate the audience enough so that they will enjoy the show, but not so much that they will become unruly and disrupt it. Peter, whom I had seen just minutes earlier with Herr Neuhoff, sneaks from the back of the beer tent with a flask in hand. How had he gotten here so quickly? He eyes me uncertainly.
"Just a quick one for the road," he says.
Before ambling away, I am surprised. I had not imagined that performers would be allowed to drink before a show. What would Astrid say? I reach the backyard. My eyes travel nervously toward the top of the tent. It seems impossible that the tent, nothing more than some fabric and poles, can possibly hold the hulking trapeze apparatus. And us. Astrid, seeing my worry, walks to my side.
It's safe.
But in my mind, I will always see the time I had fallen toward the earth, ready to die.
How are you holding up? She asks.
Without waiting for an answer, she rechecks my wrist wraps and holds out the box of rosin for me to coat my hands once more.
We don't want you getting killed, she says. Not after all of the work we've put in.
She adds this last bit with a smile, trying to make a joke of it. But her eyes are solemn, concerned. You don't think I can do it? I venture, not sure I want to hear the answer.
Of course I do.
I listen to her voice, trying to gauge whether it is forced.
You've worked hard. You've got natural ability. But this is a serious business for all of us. There is no room for mistakes.
I nod, understanding. The danger is as real for Astrid as it is for me, even after so many years. I peek inside the dark tent, which looms high like a giant cave. There is a ring in the middle, some 40 feet across, set apart from the audience by a low fence. I'd heard from the other performers about the American circuses, great big ones like Barnum that had 3 rings. But here, all eyes would be focused on the main act. The first 2 rows of seats are covered in a ruby velvet cloth with a satin gold star on each, designating that these are the good seats, the important ones. Behind these chairs, crude wood benches rise in concentric circles nearly to the rafters. It is the complete circus of the ring, spectators on all sides, that gets to me. There is nowhere to hide or turn away, eyes from every angle. The crowd begins to trickle into the tent, and I pull back so as not to be seen. The ushers and program sellers are in fact lesser performers who can scoot out as the auditorium fills to put on their own makeup and prepare for the show. I study the spectators as they take their seats, a mix of well-to-do townspeople in the front and workers on the higher benches, freshly scrubbed but a bit ill at ease, as if they do not belong here. Barely a few francs for food, yet they still found a way to get that ticket to the show. These are the lucky ones, who can afford to forget for a few hours the hardships beyond the tent flaps. As the sky grows gray, and we near showtime, the chatter in the backyard silences, and everyone grows focused, almost grim. The acrobats have one last cigarette. They are stunning in their sequined costumes and headdresses. Their flawless makeup and coiffed hair give no indication of the primitive conditions in which we dressed. Astrid paces in the far corner, deep in thought. Given the intensity of her expression, I do not dare to disturb her. Of course, I have no pre-show ritual of my own. I stand to one side, trying to act as if I have done this my whole life. Astrid waves me over.
"Don't just stand around letting your muscles get cold," she admonishes. "You need to stretch."
She bends and gestures for me to lift one leg onto her shoulder, an exercise we've done many times at the winter quarters. She straightens slowly, raising my leg, and I try not to grit my teeth, but rather breathe and ease into the dull, familiar burn that travels up the underside of my thigh. "Do you want me to stretch you?" I ask, when she has helped me with my other leg. She shakes her head. I follow her gaze across the backyard to where Peter rehearses apart from the others. He's changed into an oversized jacket and trousers now, and his face, stubbled minutes earlier, is an unbroken field of white grease paint. "Astrid," I begin. She looks over at me, as though she had nearly forgotten I was there.
"What is it?"
I falter. I consider telling her about the disagreement I heard Peter having with Herr Neuhoff on the train, or seeing Peter come from the beer tent, but I do not want to worry her right before we go on.
"You're nervous,"
she says evenly. "Yes," I admit. "Weren't you at your first show?" She laughs.
"I was so young I can't even remember it. But it is normal to be nervous. Good, even. The adrenaline will keep you on your toes, keep you from making mistakes.
Or make my hands shake so badly that I can't hold the bar, I think. Inside the tent, the lights are lowered, and the whole house thrown into darkness. A spotlight comes on, creating a pool of gold on the floor at the center of the ring. The orchestra strikes a stirring chord. Herr Neuhoff appears, majestic in his bow tie and top hat.
"Mesdames et messieurs," Herr Neuhoff booms into a microphone.
The thunder and lightning polka begins to play, and the plumed horses prance into the ring. Their riders, among the most ornately costumed of the women, have no saddle, but ride bareback, hardly sitting at all, as they scissor their legs from side to side. One rider stands and tumbles from a standing position backward through the air, landing neatly on a second horse. Though I have seen the act in rehearsal, I cannot help but gasp along with the crowd. The program of the circus, Astrid explained once, is deliberately designed. A fast act, then a slow one, then fast again. Lions and other dangerous animals, interspersed with human pantomimes. "You want the light bits after serious," she'd said. "Like cleansing the palate after each course of a meal." But there are practicalities, too, such as the time needed to bring the animal cages in and out that makes placing them close to intermission a necessity. Watching, I realize that the design of the big top is deliberate, too. The angles of the benches are steep to face the gaze downward. The rounded seating makes the crowd play off one another's responses, and the unbroken circle is like a wire for the electricity that fills the tent. The audience sits motionless, mesmerized by the web of color, lights, music, and artistry. Their eyes dance with the arc of the juggler's balls, and they gasp in appreciation as one of the trainers waltzes with a lion. Astrid was right. Even as war rages on, the people still have to live. They shop for their foodstuffs and tend their homes. Why not laugh at the circus as they had when the world was still whole? Next comes the high wire. A girl named Yetta stands at the top of a platform, holding aloft a long pole for balance. The act terrifies me even more than the trapeze, and I have thanked God several times that Herr Neuhoff had not selected me for that instead of the trapeze. There is a slow adagio in the music, a pause for dramatic value. Then, as Yetta steps out on the wire, music thunders and the whole tent seems to shiver. Yetta's foot slips, and she struggles to regain her balance. Why now? In this act she has practiced and performed dozens of times. She nearly rights herself, then wobbles again, this time too far to recover. There is a collective gasp as she falls through the air screaming, limbs flailing as if trying to swim.
"No!"
I cry aloud. In her descent, I see the day Astrid had pushed me all over again. I start forward. We have to help her. But Astrid pulls me back. Yetta lands in the net, which crashes low to the ground. She lies there, not moving. The spectators seem to hold their breath, as if wondering whether to worry or if the fall is just part of the act. Workers rush forward to carry her from the ring, out of sight of the crowd. Watching Yetta's limp body, I grow terrified. That could happen to me. Yetta is rushed outside to a Peugeot that has pulled up behind the big top. I expected an ambulance, but the workers bundle her in the back of the car, and it drives away.
An accident at the first show of the season,
a voice beside me says, spicy breath warm on my bare shoulder. Though we have never spoken, I recognize the woman with flowing silver hair as Drina, the gypsy who reads fortunes on the midway before the show and at intermission.
A terrible omen.
Nonsense, Astrid says, waving her hand dismissively. But her face is grave. Will Yetta be all right? I ask, when Drina has gone.
I don't know, Astrid says bluntly. Even if she lives, she may not perform again.
She made living without the show sound almost worse than dying. Do you believe the fortune teller? I hear myself asking too many questions. About a bad omen, I mean.
Bah!
Astrid waves her hand. If she can really see the future, then what is she doing stuck here? She has a point. I peer into the tent where the crowd waits uncertainly. Surely the rest of the show will have to be cancelled. But the performers stand close, still ready to go on.
Clowns! Schnell!
Herr Neuhoff calls, signaling quickly for the next act. The clowns tumble in, pantomiming a city scene. Happy clowns with large shoes and tiny little hats, musical clowns, buffoons who mock everything. Peter seems to fit into none of these. He steps into the ring last, his face white and red with great black lines, eyeing the audience as though they have kept him waiting. Not sad, but a serious clown, his wit acerbic, smiles hard won. While the other clowns perform a skit in tandem, Peter dances on the periphery, creating a pantomime all his own. He holds the entire chapiteau captive, cajoling, teasing, sensing who is reticent to come along on the journey, or perhaps weary and drawing them in. It is as if he wills the audience to please him with their response and applause, when in fact the opposite should be the case. From the darkness in the corner, Astrid watches Peter, eyes rapt. Herr Neuhoff also watches from the edge of the ring, his face uneasy. I hold my breath, waiting for Peter to launch into the goose-stepping routine Herr Neuhoff had forbidden. Peter has not incorporated the pro-Vichy anthem Herr Neuhoff suggested earlier into his act. But he keeps his performance light, as if sensing that after Yetta's fall, anything else would be too much. The clowns are followed by the elephants in their jeweled headpieces, the bear and monkeys in little dresses, not unlike my own. The show breaks for intermission, and the house lights go up. Patrons make their way back to the midway to stretch their legs and smoke. But the break is not for us.
We're next, Astrid informs me. We must get ready.
Astrid, wait. A giant pit seems to open in my stomach. Until now, I had just been a spectator at the show, nearly forgetting the real reason I am here. But to actually step out in front of the crowd, after what happened to Yetta? How can I possibly? I can't do this. My mind is a blur, and I've forgotten everything. Of course you can, she reassures, placing a hand on my shoulder.
That's just your nerves.
No, I've forgotten everything. I'm not ready. My voice rises with panic. A few of the other performers turn in my direction. One of the acrobats curves her mouth smugly, as if everything she expected about me has proved true. Astrid leads me away, and then stops, placing one hand on each of my shoulders.
Now listen to me. You are good. Gifted, even. And you have worked hard. Ignore the audience, and imagine it is just the two of us back in Darmstadt. You can do this.
She kisses me firmly on each cheek, as if pressing some of her calm and strength into me. Then she turns and starts for the ring. A bell sounds, and the audience returns to their seats. As I peer beyond the curtain at the crowd that waits expectantly, my legs grow heavy.
I cannot possibly step out there. Go, Astrid growls, pushing me out roughly as the music cues us.
As the house lights dim once more, we scamper into the ring. In the winter quarters, the ladder had been bolted to the wall. But here, it dangles from above, scarcely held in place at the bottom. I struggle not to fall as it wobbles. The climb takes longer than I expected, and I have only just reached the board when the spotlight rises. It licks the sides of the tent, finds me, and then I am displayed before the crowd. I shiver. Why is it that the clowns can hide behind the oily grease paint while we stand nearly naked, nothing but a thin slip of nylon separating us from hundreds of eyes? The music slows, signaling the start of our act. Then there is silence, followed by a drum roll that grows louder. My cue to leap.
Hup!
Comes Astrid's call across the darkness. I am supposed to release right after she says it, but I do not. Astrid swings, waiting for me. In another second, it will be too late, and the act will be a failure. With a deep breath, I leap from the board. Suddenly, there is nothing beneath my feet but air. Though I have flown dozens of times in the winter quarters, I feel a second of sheer terror, as if it is the first time all over again. I swing higher, pushing fear away and relishing the air as it whooshes around me. Astrid flies toward me, arms extended. I have to let go at the top of the arc for the trick to work. The catch still terrifies me, though, and more so now than ever after seeing Yetta fall. Astrid had let me fall once before, caused it. Would she do it again? Our eyes lock. Trust me, she seems to say. I let go and soar through the air. Astrid's hands clasp mine, swinging me below her for a split second. Relief and excitement surge through me. There is no time to celebrate, though. A second later, Astrid flings me back in the direction I need to go. I force myself to concentrate once more, spinning as she taught me. Then I reach outward, hardly daring to look. Astrid has aligned me perfectly, and the bar falls into my hands, and the crowd cheers. I swing up to the board, the world righting itself beneath my feet. We've done it! My heart fills with joy, and I am happier than I've been since I can remember. The act is not over, though, and Astrid is waiting for me, her face stern, intensity unbroken. We perform the second pass, this time Astrid catching me by my feet. The applause lifts me higher now. Another pass and return, then it is over. For an instant, I am almost more sad than relieved. I straighten as the spotlight finds me on the board. The audience cheers on and on. For me. They haven't seen the work Astrid had done as catcher at all. I understand then how hard it was for her to have given up the limelight, the thing she has sacrificed to bring me into the act. The lights go down, and Peter prepares to enter the ring once more, this time for a solo performance. Unlike other performers who appear once or twice during the show, he goes on repeatedly between larger acts, a thread tying the whole show together. Now he distracts the crowd with his routine, giving the workers time to finish positioning the lion and tiger cages, which had been brought in through the darkness beneath our act. Estrid and I climb down and hurry out to the backyard in the semi-darkness. "We did it!" I exclaim, throwing my arms around Estrid. I wait for her praise. Surely now she will be pleased with me. But she does not respond, and a second later, I step back, dejected.
"You did well,"
she says, finally. But her tone is understated, and her face is troubled. "I know I was late on the first pass," I begin.
"Shh!"
She shoos me away, staring into the tent. I follow her gaze to where a man sits in the front row, in an SS uniform. I am suddenly queasy. Surely I would have noticed him if he had been there during the first half of the show. He must have come in during intermission. In my nervousness, I had not seen him. "I'm sure he is just here to see the show," I say, wanting to reassure her. But there is no strength behind my words. What on earth is a German officer doing here? His expression is relaxed as he watches the trainer cajole the big cats into doing tricks. "Still, you have to warn Peter not to do that bit in his next act." I stop, realizing she isn't listening, but still peering rapt through the curtain. "I know him." Estrid's voice is calm, but her skin has gone pale. "The German?" She nods. "Are you sure?" I ask over the tightening in my throat. They all look so similar in those awful uniforms. "An associate of my husband's. Ex-husband," I want to correct, but in the moment it seems unwise.
"You can't go out there again," I fret.
Though I am done for the show, Estrid has a second act on the Spanish web. My chest tightens.
"You must tell Herr Neuhoff."
"Never,"
she spits out, sounding more angry than scared now.
"I don't want him to worry about having me in the act. If I cannot perform, I have no value to the show."
And then Herr Neuhoff's protection would be just charity. She faces me squarely.
"It would be the end of me. You must swear not to tell. No one can know."
"Let me go on for you,"
I plead. Of course my offer is hollow. I have no training on the ropes, or any other act beyond the trapeze. I turn and look behind me desperately. Peter, if I can find him, might be able to persuade Estrid not to go on.
"Estrid, please wait."
But it is too late. She strides into the ring, shoulders squared with determination. In that moment, I see just how brave she really is. I am awed and petrified for her. Estrid climbs a different ladder from the one she had used earlier. This time she hangs from a single satin rope, seemingly suspended in midair. I hold my breath, studying the officer's face for some sign of recognition. But he watches her, too mesmerized to suspect. She tells a story, weaves a tapestry with her moves. It holds him, and the entire audience, captivated. I remain terrified, though, unable to breathe. Estrid's beauty and the legendary skill of her act scream like a bullhorn, threatening to betray her true identity. "Hidden in plain sight," Estrid muses over the thundering applause as she exits the tent. There is a note of self-satisfaction to her voice, a part of her that liked deceiving the German. But her hands tremble as she undoes her wraps. Then, it is over. The entire circus steps out for a final bow. The full panoply of spectacle unfurled for the audience to admire once more. I climb the ladder, as Astrid had instructed me, and we take our final bow from opposing boards, not flying, but simply extending one leg high out into the air like ballerinas. Children wave furiously at the sweat-glistening performers, who bow modestly in return, like actors not breaking from their roles. Afterward, some of the performers sign autographs for the crowd that has gathered at the edge of the backyard. I watch nervously as Astrid accepts praise. Perhaps she should not be out here. But the German officer does not appear. At the far end of the yard, I see Peter, not signing autographs, but pacing and talking to himself as intently as he had before the beginning of the show. He is going over his performance, finding the mistakes, and marking the things he will fix for next time. The circus artists are every bit as intent as a ballet dancer or concert pianist. Every tiny flaw is a gaping wound, even though it had not been noticed by anyone else at all. When the last program has been signed, we make our way back to the train, past the workers scrubbing down and feeding the animals. Once there might have been fireworks after the first evening show, Astrid remarks, staring up at the darkness of the sky. But not anymore? I ask. Too expensive, she replies. And no one seems to find explosions enjoyable these days. Weariness engulfs me then. My bones ache, and my skin is chilled with dry sweat. All I want to do is return to Theo and collapse around the sweet warmth of his body. But Astrid cajoles me back to the dressing car, where we hang our costumes and remove our makeup. She rubs warm salve into my shoulders, pine-scented and tingly. I just want to sleep, I protest, trying to shrug her off. Our bodies are all that we have in this business. We must take care of them. You'll be glad tomorrow, she promises, her fingers digging hard into my neck. My muscles burn like fire. You did beautifully, Astrid continues, her voice full and sincere, offering the praise I had longed for earlier. My heart seems to skip a beat. Of course, your legs could have been a bit straighter on the second pass, she adds, bringing me down to earth. Because Astrid will always be Astrid. We can fix that tomorrow. Tomorrow, I think. The days of endless practices and shows stretching out before me. I'm proud of you, she adds, and I can feel my cheeks flush. We start from the dressing car toward the sleeper. Then I stop. I am worried still about the German officer who saw her, and the possibility that he might realize who she is. Astrid will not tell anyone. But should I? I look in the direction of Peter's car. He cares for her, I can tell, and would be the best person to keep her safe. If I go to him, though, he will tell Astrid. Herr Neuhoff, I think. I have spoken to him little since arriving at the circus, but he has always been kind. It is his circus. Surely he will know what to do. I see Astrid's glowering face, hear her voice. No one can know. She will be furious if she finds out I have gone against her. But Herr Neuhoff runs the circus. He is my best hope of keeping Astrid safe. I desperately want to get to Theo. He will be sleeping, though. And there is something else I must do first. I forgot something, I say, turning back in the other direction before she can answer any questions. I knock at the door of Herr Neuhoff's carriage, the last one before the caboose.
Come in!
He calls from inside, and I open the door. I've never been here before. Inside, it is pleasantly furnished, a curtain separating the bed and sitting areas. Herr Neuhoff sits at a desk, his girth threatening to topple the rickety chair beneath. He's taken off the velvet jacket he wore in the ring and opened